Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. This is a Design for Living Big Book meeting of Overeaters Anonymous. My name is Rhonda, and I am a compulsive eater and your chairperson for today. To open the meeting, let us have a moment of quiet meditation followed by the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. We start this meeting by remembering our common purpose, to extend the heart and hand of the OA Fellowship to those who still suffer. Let us be mindful of OA's unity with diversity policy, which respects our differences, yet unites us in the solution to our common problem. Whatever problem you may have with food, you are welcome at this meeting. Today, we are delighted to have Samantha joining us to share her experience, strength, and hope, focused on traditions 7 and 8. Tradition 7, every OA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. And Tradition 8, Overeaters Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. I would now like to welcome Samantha to the group to share her journey in OA and her experience with Tradition 7.
Thanks, Rhonda. Hello, everybody. Good morning, good evening, good night. How lovely to be here. Thank you for asking me to speak on these two traditions. It's been a really marvelous exercise to really delve into them both. My name's Samantha. I'm a compulsive overeater. I have 27 years of abstinence, a day at a time, being held by the loving arms of this fellowship and by the grace of God. I currently do service at all three levels, at my intergroup for Region 10, and I'm going to my first World Service Business Conference this year. So that's very exciting. I've been in OA since 1987. I won't go into my abstinence stories particularly, but that means I've been in OA longer than I've been out of OA in my entire life. So that's pretty amazing. I just wanted to begin actually by telling you a story. And it was when I was first abstinent, and it is why I can. It set the foundation for why I do service. This happened, I was probably around 25, I think. I had been abstinent for 2 years and then I busted. At the time, I was very unwell. I had an illness that was diagnosed, but for which there was no cure, and there was no sense of how long I would continue to be unwell for. And I was pretty much housebound. At that time, I got another sponsor. She took me through the big book, and I became abstinent again. And from then, I take my abstinent counting. At this point in time, when this story happened, I'd probably been abstinent for about 6 months. And my partner, who's now my husband, became very ill. And he went into hospital and had some surgery. And he was about to come home, and I rang my sponsor in a panic because I was very unwell, and my partner had been looking after me, and he was about to come home from hospital, and I was in a complete panic. I didn't know what to do. How was I going to look after my partner, who was very unwell. I didn't know how I was going to get everything done. I felt like I needed to clean the house. I didn't know how I was going to prepare the meals. I didn't know how I was going to look after this person. And my sponsor listened to me, and she was kind of sympathetic, and she, you know, I think she might have given me a few ideas or suggestions about what to do. But I was in such a panic that I kept doing that thing of going, of finding reasons why those things wouldn't work. And finally, in her frustration, she said to me, "I don't know, Sam, the only thing that's helped me when I'm in a crisis is to do service." And I was completely stunned, because I was like, I'm the one that needs the help here. People should be running after me. People should be coming over and helping me do things, not me giving service to other people. But I just took it on, and I was pretty desperate to remain abstinent. So I did what she said. And it was one of those beautiful moments where things just continued to unfold then, outside of my hands, without me having to do anything, without having to do anything in particular. You know, I realized that I didn't have to clean the house from head to toe, that I didn't, that my husband wasn't going to die if the dust on the window sills remained there, that I didn't, you know, I didn't have to by myself prepare 3 nutritious, completely balanced meals a day for him. And it did unfold. And so this principle, this action became the bedrock for my abstinence. So for me, I do prayer, abstinence, and service. And if I have done those 3 things in a day, it's a good day. No matter how much I've failed anywhere else, no matter how many things have gone wrong, prayer, abstinence, and service. 1 small piece of service a day. What I found when I did that 1 piece of service was it broke the whirlwind of my own thinking. It broke me out of that whirlwind of self. It literally broke that, because I had to reach out and care for somebody else. And also in breaking that whirlwind, it's like it made an opening for my higher power to come into my life. And this is what I feel service does so beautifully, is that it breaks open that self-focus, the panic, I can only see my own vision of things when I'm in that kind of state. But when I make an action that takes me out of myself towards another person, it stops that whirlwind of thinking. But also it creates a channel for which my higher power can then enter my life. And this is what I feel like, this is the real magic of giving service to me, the real transforming power of giving service. And that's the kind of foundation of why I do service a day at a time. So I'm going to move straight into the 7th tradition, and we'll just see how we'll go with the timing of things. As I said, it's been a beautiful exercise to look at these traditions closer in preparing for today. I'm not an expert on the traditions by any means. So, yeah, it's been a real gift. Tradition 7, every OA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. It seems very simple, seems very obvious in a way, because we're so used to this, hearing this tradition. What I found in preparing for this is that there are all sorts of nuances and deeper resonance in these traditions that I hadn't found before. So I'll elaborate on that as we go. When I read through this tradition and I was thinking about it, two words continued to return to me: responsibility, which is the principle of this tradition, and freedom. And the two go hand in hand. I think many of us belong to societies where the idea of freedom is something where we are free from all responsibilities. We are able to luxuriate. We're able to do whatever we want to do. We can go wherever we want to go. We can have whatever we want to have. We can be like the wind and do whatever we want to do. There's a sense of abundance and carefreeness and ease, I suppose. And I think often in our society, the idea of responsibility is not something that's always paired with that idea of freedom. But for me, this tradition in particular grounds me in that idea of responsibility bringing freedom. There are lots of things to think about in this tradition, but one of the primary ones is this very concrete reality about money. It can be a bit of a dirty word, the money word. But the concrete reality in OA is that we need money in order for our fellowship to continue to function. And in my recovery, I've always been much more interested in the steps and in the recovery of myself and other people, in the kind of wonder and light of what the steps can do in people's lives. In recognizing the subtle shifts of the soul as we continue to recover, or watching the magical transformation of somebody in front of me who's working the program. But we have this hard reality as well. We need money to keep OA functioning. So at group level, that's paying for rent, for Zoom accounts, the PI project, websites and offices. At regional level, it's different in different regions, but in my region, in region 10, we span two continents and up to 10 different countries in region 10. So there are all sorts of costs involved in that. There's the cost of travel. Our trustee travels to different countries to do workshops with different people. So she travels to Japan, South Korea, Singapore, the Philippines. She's been to China as well as Australia and New Zealand. So there's a lot of cost in that. But what an extraordinary thing to be able to do to bring the OA message to those people who are suffering with the disease in those countries. There's the need for interpretation, which we're just very excitingly, because of the changes in technology, being able to do very easily. And then at world service level, there's the costs of producing literature. Again, there's translation costs, interpretations, and then service centres, of course, in which we pay special workers, which we will get to in Tradition 8. And all of this energy, all of this money and time goes into bringing the message to the still suffering compulsive overeater. And it's all paid for by our seventh tradition. And when I think of these things, I have a great sense of pride, and there's a real dignity in that for me, in that I belong to this fellowship where that does these things, that takes this message, that takes responsibility, that can bring about this wonderful transformation in people who are caught in the disease of compulsive overeating. When I first did my first fourth step, one of the basic defects of character for me was not taking responsibility for myself. I wanted others to look after me. I wanted them to tell me I was right. I wanted them to tell me I was worthy. And then over the years, as I began to take responsibility for myself, as I began to risk my own decision, making my own decisions and getting things wrong, I started to also learn who I was and what I thought about things, because I was no longer looking for outside recognition. I began to learn who I was. I discovered the depth of my own humanity because I made mistakes. And that meant that I became more compassionate to those around me also. And this was, there was a great freedom in that. I was no longer caught in this fantasy, caught in this fantastical thinking about who I should be, who I thought I wanted to be. Again, like that example of service, it broke that fantastical thinking. I had to start living in this concrete reality. And at times that was a bit brutal, but at other times it was completely magical, because I think that I'd always wanted to know. I think self-knowledge and knowing oneself as our higher powers want to know us, is one of the great gifts and one of the great freedoms of the program. If I start to know myself, I'm become free to make my own decisions and to live life as God, as I call my higher power, would have me live life, not constantly living in a fantastical world. This is enormously rewarding, because then the gifts and the loves and the achievements were mine, and I became a part of life. And it's similar with this tradition. Every time I put in for the seventh tradition, I'm adding to the reality of recovery for myself and for the still suffering compulsive overeater. I'm saying, when I put in my hard-earned cash, this is what I believe in. I'm committing to that ever-humbling reality that I am a compulsive overeater who is no better and no worse than anybody else. And in that space, I start to learn that I am truly loved by my higher power, and that I truly belong. So this hard reality actually brings a sense of belonging and of being loved for who I am. And that is a great, great freedom, because I'm not constantly outside of myself trying to be something that I'm not, berating myself, living in fantastical worlds. So this tradition is bringing us back to that hard reality. It's bringing us back to the the reality that we live in day by day, and in which I belong, which is quite extraordinary for a compulsive overeater who thought she was either so abject that she should be nothing more than dust under a rock, or conversely, with an addict's mind, so brilliant that nobody else could touch her. This hard reality brings me back. It puts my feet on the ground. Every time we put into the seventh tradition basket, we are adding to that hard reality. This is who I am. This is what I believe in. This is where I am seen completely as I am through the loving eyes of my higher power. Then we come to the second part of the tradition. We are fully for self-supporting, declining outside contributions. So in the 12 and 12, there are great descriptions of the dangers of this, the pitfalls that may come if we were to accept outside contribution. And these are things like that people donating more might within OA, because of course in OA we have limits on how much that we can donate at one time, that people donating more might consciously or unconsciously believe they have more, they should have more say in decision making, that if we have outside contributions that we may become dependent on the money that's been donated. We might feel the need to maintain good relationships with this donor. In the 12 and 12, it says, if we accept free gifts from outsiders, we become less than free ourselves. So my understanding of this is that what happens if we start relying on outside donations, if we start thinking of putting in more so that we could have more say, if we start relying on a member who's adding more money all the time, is that what happens is it can create subtle or unsubtle sometimes shifts away from our ultimate authority, who is God as we understand him or her. And this breaks the beautiful spiritual flow of our fellowship. It creates blocks and diversions and ruptures in what is this extraordinary source that undergirds our entire fellowship, which is God as we understand him or her. Because when God is our ultimate authority, we are all equal. If we take outside contributions, there's a power shift away from our ultimate authority and towards fallible people, towards money that becomes so complex. We begin to create sliding shifts of worth in the program. Who donates more has more worth, has more power. If we offend the donor, will they take the donations? These take us away from the freedom of all being equal in the eyes of our higher powers. So if we become reliant on donors, we lose this opportunity of partaking in the risk of becoming truly ourselves, of becoming truly alive. If each of us is equal in the eyes of our higher power, our higher power wants each of us to bring our full selves to this program, to the decision making. Each of us becomes necessary to bringing the fellowship to its fullest, to its most active, to its most giving. We need to continue to bring our eyes to our ultimate authority. And this is what I've been learning in sitting quietly and taking longer with the traditions. These traditions continue to guide us back to this ultimate authority, to the source and to the power of this ultimate authority. Because we're all human and we all fall into these traps of thinking we know a better way, or thinking we can find a solution, or wanting subtle shifts of power, wanting to make things happen ourselves. But this very gracious tradition means that we continue to put our feet down, say what we believe, who we are, as enough to continue to fuel our fellowship, to bring the message of compulsive overeating to those who still suffer. And this is the freedom. This is the freedom that awakens our fellowship, that awakens us within the fellowship. It's not about yachts and anything we want. It's the freedom that comes with being fully alive as who we are. And there's something about bringing our attention to concrete realities that awakens that in all of us. So I reckon I'm about 30 seconds out. Thank you.
Thank you, Samantha, so much for sharing your experience, strength, and hope with us today on Tradition 7. We will now be transitioning to a question and answer segment, and I'd like to introduce Dean, who is our moderator for today. Thank you.
Thank you, Rhonda. Hello, my name is Dean. I am a compulsive feeder and your moderator for today. Please continue to send your questions on Tradition 7 to me using the chat. We will try to get through as many questions as we can today. Our first question is, can you share more on the way you link responsibility and freedom in the context of personal relationships in applying mm-hmm. Tradition 7 in your life and relationship?
There are two things that come to mind for me in that. The first, in relation to relationships, I'm going to talk about responsibility and freedom. And then I'll talk about money. Responsibility and freedom, I think, especially and service. I've been married now for, 24, 25 years or something like that. Being married was never something that I, aspired to. It wasn't something that I, since I was a little girl, wanted to be married. But it has been, and my husband and I have been together for 30 plus years. This idea of responsibility, I feel that, again, for me, going back to that initial fourth step and realizing that I wanted other people to take responsibility for myself, the learning to take responsibility for me, the learning for me of how to take responsibility for myself meant that I I can only bring it back again to starting to know who I was. And I think also, you know, like many of us, there was trauma in my background. And part of my trauma was that I, you know, split in two. So for me, learning to reconcile those two parts of myself has become one of the major healing factors in my journey. So learning to take responsibility for myself, again, has been about letting go of the fantasy and the delusion of who I should be and learning about who I am. And I can only say that in learning who I am, I've been able to bring that person to my husband rather than the idea of who I should be and the idea of who he should be. So there's great liberation in that too, because there's a huge risk that the person will not like who I actually am. But I've never found that. I've only ever found that in presenting myself honestly and with vulnerability, with and even presenting what I would consider to be the most abject, the most shameful part of myself, I've only ever found that those things have been met with love. Because vulnerability draws out love in other people. In terms of this tradition, again, I can only say that money, the idea of us being self-supporting, and it's not, of course, just about money. It's about skills and time. And I think there's a lot to be said about time as a resource that's difficult to give over in our very fast-paced world. That the idea of giving from what I have rather than pulling on delusions or fantasies or other people's resources, again, simply means I become more of who I am and I can give of more who I am. And I feel like that encourages other people to give of who they are, because I'm not spending all my time looking for them to look after me. If I put my feet on the ground, if I start growing my own roots in the earth, there's a great freedom to be who I am. And then there's a great freedom to see the other person as who they are. It's enormously risky, but it's also completely exhilarating. It's becoming truly alive. In relation to money with this tradition and my own life, I think there's all my own skills and how to give them, becoming, relying on our own skills, our own resources. I feel like the service work that I've done in OA, where I bring my own skills and my own resources that are monetarily and about the qualities I am as a person. Again, I find out who I am rather than thinking I have to do everything. The more I find out who I am, I also understand the limits of who I am, and I can appreciate that other people bring other things to this quest of bringing the message to the self-suffering compulsive overeater.
Just to move on to the next question, and some of this, what you've just said, rolls into this one. I want to help, but I don't feel I have money to give to OA. Is turning up to meetings and helping enough?
Of course. Of course.
Short and sweet. I don't trust my local OA group to spend the money wisely. I would rather donate to a local soup kitchen, but then I don't even do that. What do you do if you feel this way?
I've not been in that circumstance before. What I would do would be to do a fourth step on my fears about the group. And then I would bring what my fears are to the group conscience and see how other people will respond to those. I have found in the past that in doing that, either other people feel the same way, or that at least then I've added what I believe is an issue instead of always blaming the other people for not doing what I think is right. So responsibility then is bringing my concerns to the group. And I guess once that's done, asking for the group conscience and asking in a humble way for this to be considered might be the first step in addressing that fear. I guess if you found that unsatisfying, you could then donate directly to World Service.
Wonderful, thank you. Your comments on fantastical thinking, could you talk more about how you broke away from that, including how you gave up the ego payoffs and pleasures of indulging in that fantastical thinking?
Oh, yes, completely. It's such a constant learning, this fantastic and delusional thinking. And I don't think that it's, I feel less berating about it than I used to. Step work, of course, always, always. Looking at fears, getting fears out on the paper, looking at resentments, all of these things, doing, as we were just talking about in the first one, risking bringing my thinking and concerns to whatever the problem is. There's a double-edged sword in fantastical thinking. You know, I work in a field that's very reliant on the imagination, and this is a marvelous thing, the capacity to think and envision things for the future, to think about how to bring things about, to imagine possible scenarios, to even at times to escape into other worlds. The thing for me as a compulsive overeater is that eventually I'll binge if I continue to do that, because I am a material being. I live in a world of substance. I can't live in my head. And living in my head, I feel like I have to be in these other worlds, that I want to be in these other worlds. But life will interrupt those other worlds whether I want to or not. In the very prosaic things, bills need to be paid, I need to turn up to work. At the emotional level, somebody will disappoint me or I will hurt somebody else. There'll be a conflict that comes about. These are things that help rupture those fantasies, and they're a great invitation to actually enter into my own life. And I do that by addressing them with the steps. Thank you.
I would like to hand back to Rhonda for the second edition, please, introduction.
Thank you, Dean. We will now be moving on to Tradition 8. Tradition 8 says, Overeaters Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. So I turn that over to you, Sam. Samantha, thank you.
Sam's fine, Rhonda. I always say Samantha as the initial thing because it's like being presented in a ball gown. But in Australia, we always go to Sam within the next sentence anyway. So you just get to see me in my t-shirt and shorts. Tradition 8. So the principle that goes with Tradition 8 is fellowship. And again, staying with this, sitting with this and thinking about this tradition, this principle of fellowship really shone through for me. I'm just going to read the first paragraph of the 12 and 12 to begin with. OA is built upon a foundation of sharing our experience, strength, and hope, one member to another, with no strings attached. As OA members, we may donate many hours of service to each other, sponsoring, speaking at meetings, and doing necessary committee and other service work. For this, none of us receives payment in money. Our reward is something money can't buy, our own personal recovery. So this, for me, is the basis of the tradition. The emphasis is on recovery rather than money. And this emphasis on recovery being our currency, say, creates a sense of trust in our fellowship. There is no other motivation for us being in this, in our rooms, but our own recovery. That's an extraordinary thing, really, isn't it? Extraordinary in the world that we live in, so full of cynicism and people out to get what they can get and to further themselves and further their dreams. And in our rooms, the only currency is recovery. It is quite an extraordinary thing. That for me brings a bedrock of trust to what we do. There is no other motivation. And that means that there's a bedrock of trust in what we do. And I think that means that people, that is why people can share openly and honestly in our meetings. And I guess for me, again, this brings us back to the sense of flow that and spiritual foundation that undergirds, that our tradition safeguards, the source of which, of course, is our higher power. We remain unprofessional. And that means that we all have an equal voice. There are no experts in OA. And this is a beautiful reminder that our higher power works through every single one of us, through newcomers, those working towards abstinence, those with abstinence, those who've been around a long time. Our higher power works through every single one of us. And I'm sure many, many, if not all of us, have had that experience of having an insight from something that somebody completely unexpected has said in a meeting. Or even better, somebody that you don't like, or somebody that you don't particularly, you know, respect or admire. I've certainly had that, and it's brought me up. It brought me up suddenly. In OA, with recovery as our only currency, it means that our higher power is trusting each of us to bring something to the rooms. And our higher power works in surprising ways. And this sense of spiritual flow comes out in that. That insight comes from many different directions. This tradition also reminds us that even though we bring different, we have different professional skills, we have different life experiences, and we bring different qualities to our service work, even in that, we all remain equal. We do service to serve. That's quite extraordinary, isn't it? Again, in a world that's fueled by such different priorities. We do service to serve. To serve becomes the fuel that runs the engine of our fellowship. It's not money, it's not fame, it's not celebrity, it's not self-seeking, it's not lifestyle. We have no other reward in the program than recovery. And we are all having the same reward. We are all looking for the same reward. What an extraordinary principle of equality that is. And again, the reward then becomes so much about becoming more who we are as people. To fully give of ourselves, to fully become ourselves in order that we can continue to give and serve. So this tradition is saying that the only place for paid professionals within the fellowship is as we need them for our service centres, where the amount of time needed to accomplish certain tasks is too much for volunteers. And we need to acknowledge that sometimes there's a limit to what we can do as volunteers, and that's a great stepping into the reality of what it is to be in the program, the reality that we live in. So we pay volunteers where it takes too much time to do the tasks that are needed, or where there are special skills needed that our volunteer base doesn't have or can't bring. So they can be things like interpretation, expertise in technology. This tradition always also highlights that there are no experts in recovery. So we're not psychotherapists or counsellors or dietitians. We simply share our own experience, strength and hope. So I feel this keeps us honest. The image I get from this is that in OA, we're in the business of daily bread rather than elaborate feasts. Because we know that our riches come from this simple giving, this simple serving. It grounds us again in the spirit of equality and anonymity and the reliance on our high power. And for me, it does this thing of creating the vessel in which we are all needed. The ship that we are all needed, where we are all needed in this collective effort of recovery, for our own recovery, for the recovery of others and in taking the message to the still suffering compulsive overeater. We are not reliant on one professional or one expert. Our recovery comes from the collection of all the voices in the room. So, because our sharing and our service is freely given, there's no other motive. For our personal recovery, the blessing of seeing others' recovery, our own recovery, this becomes the substance, the currency, the substance that binds us. What is freely given, what is honest, what is vulnerable, what is grateful, what is blessed. And this giving is another aspect of the love that binds us together. I just want to quickly end by talking about the word fellowship, because I went and looked it up, and there are a lot of different definitions, but one that I liked was the quality and state of being comradely. That means being in meaningful communication for building trust. Or there was another one that said a body of companions. And so then I looked up the word fellow, and it comes from an old English word, philagar, which means a partner, one who shares with another. Now, you don't want to look that up too far, because then it goes on to real estate and that sort of thing. But this idea of one that shares with another as a fellow, and then fellowship, it's the ship in which we're all being carried, one sharing with another, the fellowship. It's the vessel that we all travel in together. And for me, that vessel is the steps, the traditions, and the concepts. And this is the idea of fellowship. We are all traveling together in this sense of giving what we can freely, sharing ourselves freely. Thank you.
Thank you, Samantha, for sharing your experience, strength, and hope with us today. We will now be moving into a question and answer segment again. Welcome back to our moderator, who will be leading that. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is still Dean. I'm still a compulsive overeater, and thank you for your answers there, Samantha. Actually, we haven't had questions rolling from this last tradition. So maybe whilst people gather their thoughts, I can go back to a couple of the questions on tradition 7 that we didn't get to. And the next one was, can you give us an example of what you meant by one bit of service a day and what that may look like to you?
Yeah, absolutely. So when I was very, very ill, it was simply I took on the role as the office coordinator for our local intergroup. One piece of service a day would be ringing somebody about that in relation to that. So one phone call when I was very unwell. So it didn't need to be any more than that. Sometimes when I had small children, my one piece of service had to be focused towards the family, and service then being the doing and the giving freely. So rather than it being a burden or a job, I will do this one piece of service freely. And so it changed when I had young children, and I was still unwell, and my husband also remained unwell, but we had children, which was amazing.
What kind of things do you define as being outside contributions?
I'm not really an expert on this, but I presume it's it could be something like a donation from a weight loss program, you know. So a weight loss program might say, we'll give you $10,000 a year so that our members can come to your fellowship as well as do our weight loss program. That is what I imagine an outside donation would be. It might be that the church or the building that houses the OA meeting might say, we'll give you a donation of $5,000 a year, or we'll give you the room for free because we know that what you do is of worth. But again, we don't want to be beholden in any way to somebody outside our fellowship. So it would be up to the group to take that to their group conscience and see whether they felt they were being self-supporting by taking the free rent in that circumstance.
Thank you. Next question. Can you share more about the idea of remaining non-professional in Tradition 8 as it relates to our personal relationships?
Personal relationships. I don't know. non-professional as it relates to our personal relationships. I guess the question is talking about that idea of giving freely. I'm not quite sure how I can speak more about that in relation to our personal relationships. Perhaps the person could give some more information.
Thank you. What kinds of things do you define? Oh, you've done that one, sorry, yeah. You've done that one, haven't you? Yeah, sorry. That gives us more time for more questions, please, guys. I haven't got any more on that on perhaps, the screen right now.
Perhaps I could just talk a little bit more about time in relation to our own resources. Is that okay?
That's wonderful. Thank you.
I feel like for me, time has become something that is sometimes even more precious than money in the way that we are in the program. I feel like time has sped up in the time that I've been in the program, so that it's harder for people to feel they have the time to give service. I see time as a very precious resource, as we all do. I struggle with this a lot in terms of service work. I don't want to give over my time to doing service work in OA a lot of the time, some of the time, especially when I take on new service work, I should say, and it takes more time. And I struggle because I think I could be doing all these other things rather than doing this service work. And at this, you know, at this, I'm talking at this level, it doesn't matter what it is, whether it's 10 minutes or half an hour, an hour, or, you know, 2 hours a day or whatever it is. And when I took on the position of vice chair of Region 10, I really, really struggled. I remember going for a walk because I'd been tapped on the shoulder and praying to God, you really have to help me with this. I was swearing, you really have to help me with this because I don't want to do it. I don't want to give over this time to this particular thing. So if you want me to do it, you are really going to have to make it clear to me. And slowly, you know, the sense of it's okay, it'll be okay, you'll be okay, this is the thing I want you to do became clearer. And so I gave over the time. What I find is when I give over time, I learn things that I hadn't imagined. So if I'm battling because I want to do more of my own work, not more service work, my imagining of my work, I can imagine what that is. I can know what it is I want to research. I can know what it is I want to be writing about, whatever it is. But when I take on service work, I don't know the gifts that are going to come to me. And what I found is in taking on service work at this level, I've learned how to chair meetings. And this skill of chairing meetings has helped me enormously in the way that I work with people in my professional life. This is a gift that I couldn't have imagined for myself. And again, somehow, it brings me more into myself. This tension between the imagined life and the life that I actually live in, which I think is a tension rather than a defect. Service work brings me very groundedly into the life that I actually am. It grounds me in the fact that I'm a compulsive overeater. And I don't want to be a compulsive overeater. I don't want to be given all my time to, not all my time, I don't want to be giving lots of time to the fellowship. Except that the more that I do it, I start to live this full and rich life. So this paradox happens. I find time hard to give over, but it seems to me the more that I give over, the more I actually live in the life that I'm given rather than in a fantasy life. And the more I live in a life I'm given surprising gifts. I learn things that I couldn't imagine. And I learn a great freedom because I'm just with other people. I'm not trying to gain attention. I'm just with other people. And that allows me to be just a person. And I often feel like I have to be so much more than just who I am. So it exercises that, it makes me practice being just this person. And the thing is that I step out into my industry then, and I see that actually I have more riches than the people in my industry that are higher up in the professional hierarchy. And I can see them looking at me, wondering what the wisdom is that I have. And it's because I've learned it here in this program with other compulsive overeaters, not grand masters, not famous people, here, just with us. Just with us lot, just with us addicted lot, you know. It's a great, great blessing.
Thank you. And the last question I have is, could you possibly expand on when you use the words fantasy and delusion, how you recognize that you may be in those two states of fantasy and delusion?
Yeah, how do you recognize that? What a great question. Practice, it's practice, it's doing the steps, it's practicing, it's making lots of mistakes. It's prayer and meditation. So I meditate twice a day. And I think meditation helps enormously to be able then to look at thoughts. To step back from and to start to know what is fantasy that's of use and fantasy that's leading me away from myself. And maybe that's the best way to think about it. I think fantasy is good, but that very thing of bringing my mind to where my hands are is enormously helpful because I can have fantasies about where my life, I want my life to go or what I want to be in. But then I need to bring my mind and my to what my hands are actually doing, to what I'm actually doing in this day. And that means coming back to who I am as a person right now, which is at times excruciatingly humbling. But then once I move past it being excruciatingly humbling, it becomes enormously liberating and joyful. It becomes a flourishing.
How does the seventh apply when you need your family to help you financially?
I guess there are lots of ways that you can give in OA, and I think it's up to everybody to take the question of how much to give to their higher power, to do fears, step work on it, fears, to do resentments on any resentments that come up. But the small, even the smallest amount that you can give, the even if it's $1 per meeting, means that you're participating in that concrete reality of being a compulsive overeater and to belonging to this fellowship. So I guess it's up to each person to decide for themselves how much they can give. If you feel that you actually cannot give any money, then I would suggest looking at different ways that you can give. So be the person that opens the room, be the take on a service position, be the person that rings the struggling member so that you can give resources, other resources to the fellowship.
Thank you, Sam. And thank you, everyone. Now it's come to the end of our time for questions and answers. I'll now hand the meeting back to Rhonda.
Thank you, Dean. A reminder that the Design for Living Big Book OA is a daily meeting. We are based out of Melbourne, Australia. 6:30 a.m. start Monday through Friday and 7:30 a.m. start Saturday and Sunday. Please check out our website for more information. www.a4l.info. Our next monthly speaker series will be held on May 8th, Tradition 9 and 10. We hope to see you there. In closing, I would like to thank you all for your service in coming here today. By following the 12 steps, attending meetings regularly, and using the OA tools, we are changing our lives. We will find hope and encouragement in Overeaters Anonymous. To the newcomer, we suggest attending at least 6 different meetings to learn the many ways that OA can help you. The opinions expressed here today are those of individual OA members and do not represent OA as a whole. Please remember our commitment to honor each other's anonymity. What you hear here, whom you see here, when you leave here, let it stay here. Let us all reach out by phone or email to newcomers, returning members, and each other. Together, we get better. To close the meeting, will Emma please unmute and read the promises? They will be on the screen. Thank you.
The promises. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we'll see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We'll lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We'll intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them.